You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
And welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. It is, as we are live recording this here, technically the beginning of the Canada Long Day weekend, and I would also like to point out, Pride. Mm. So happy to Canada and happy to all LGBT spectrum people as well. To start the show, we have an exciting program today for a variety of reasons, and not just because I'm going to probably leave here and go start an early day, midday party. also because we have several things of note. We have some interesting news, of course, but we're also joined once again, probably more in the second half. He may jump in the early part, but a recent previous guest as well, which we're happy to have back as well, David Gray Donald, who's going to be talking to us a little bit about the ongoing epic of First Nations issues, in this case Grassy Narrows, here in Canada, as well as I'm sure a few other things will get tied into that as well. I also would like to welcome back to the program, after a far too long time away, M.A. Ma.
Yay!
Sabina, of course.
Great to be back.
As well, we have Sabina and Stefan in the studio, and you didn't think there was going to be an and there, did you? And we have guest music hosts, I guess. Guest DJs in the house as well. I'll introduce them before we go to our first music break. But an action-packed and full studio today. With that, I'm actually going to throw to Stefan to introduce our opening news. I will simply tease that we have a whole bunch of international news at the end of the program. So it's all news all day today. But we're going to start locally. Stefan.
You know, I figured as you know, we here on our you know, because we have a podcast that goes, and also we're somewhat syndicated across states. So the United States, yes, today is Canada Day. So it's a little Canada focus today, and we're going to start with a dash of patriotism and then slowly disintegrate it throughout the show.
That is the Canadian way, Steph.
Yes, exactly. So starting actually with a quick story about Canada ranking second on a social progress index measuring quality of life.
We're number two.
We're number two. There's a large story here actually talking about the difficulty of actually tracking social progress and how GDP is an imperfect metric of how well people are doing.
If I can just jump in for a second, that was actually my favorite line of that entire article. It's like the second line, and it's like, turns out GDP isn't perfect. Huh.
Yeah.
Huh.
And it has like a throwaway line about how bombs are good for GDP. And it's in the middle of the entire thing. But we're going to actually cover a slightly different part of this, because we've beat down the GDP isn't perfect on the show. We haven't said it for a couple weeks, so we'll say it again. GDP is not perfect, but I think we can move on from that one. What I want to talk about really is that. So it's a whole interesting thing. The social progress imperative has this wide range of different indexes that they focus on. Canada does quite well on some of the ones you'd expect. Things like advanced education and inclusion, which we like to sort of as Canadians get to rally ourselves around that sort of thing. But what's interesting about this is. Before I get to that last part, there's also some odd ones as well. I want to call it that one of the social progress index is the amount of mobile telephone subscriptions you have, which just doesn't make any sense to me. I think it makes sense in some cases, but to rank Canada poorly because everyone doesn't have a cell phone seems like an odd metric.
But I think I could justify it, but that's not. It's
okay,
not relevant.
All right, we'll move on. I think in part maybe I should just say that everything's imperfect. We'll go back to our vegan episode and say context is everything and everything's imperfect. But what I want to get to really is that Canada identifies itself a lot by our nature and our environment. And that, according to this index, is one of the major places we've fallen down. And with that sort of, and of course this is being an environment show, we're going to focus on that today. And with that sort of brief interlude, I'm now going to throw to MA to sort of frame the show.
Yeah, thanks, Stefan. I think it comes as no surprise, given the position of the conservative government that had been in place, that we've fallen down and that our progress has disintegrated on those kinds of indicators. You know, we need to look at that as measured against other countries, but just for our own internal health and well-being, that we're not doing well in those areas. So in this show, we're going to do a bit of a Canada in review session here. So we're going to look at the major developments that have happened under a new government, basically starting from the beginning of the year. And for this first section, what we want to talk about is something that has dominated the airways, which is the notorious discussion and often divisive discussion on pipelines. So we've had a major decision come down, major court decision. So we're going to start there by looking at the recent Northern Gateway decision, and then we're going to talk about the other pipelines and the sort of political landscape and positioning that's been happening around this issue.
Yeah, great. And so the four major pipelines, of course, that were sort of in discussion right now are Northern Gateway, Energy's, Keystone XL, and Kinder Morgan. Kinder Morgan we're going to leave to the side of today's show. Keystone XL, of course, was rejected by the Obama administration late last year. Some people, I think that this is fascinating. The conservative government, four members of the conservative government have been actually using the fact that American reporters have discussed that the election of Trudeau made it easier for Obama to reject Keystone XL, and so the conservative Canadians are sort of attacking Trudeau on this fact, which I think is fascinating.
How dare you be elected?
Yes, exactly, and allow a foreign government that is this arguably the one of these superpowers of the world to be influenced by Canadian politics.
Yeah, you should have taken a hard line with the Americans and told them what to... Oh, wait, Harper tried that.
And not to mention that Trudeau campaigned on getting Keystone approved. Anyways.
Just one point on that Keystone XL issue is that now TransCanada has gone and put a lawsuit forward under NAFTA against the U.S. government for $15 billion, which is approximately double the cost of the actual project itself. And I think it's just interesting to kind of look at this as the shoe being on the other foot, because we've had a lot of American companies come in and sue Canada under NAFTA, making Canada the most sued, quote-unquote, developed country in the world. And now we've got one of our companies, not that I say that with any sort of pride at all, going and suing the U.S. government, who has, by the way, never lost a NAFTA lawsuit under the mechanism, the court mechanism, or the legal mechanism under NAFTA before. So it'll be interesting, again, in quotes, to see how this plays out.
Although, of course, before that even gets to the courts, Trump's going to get elected and repeal NAFTA, so they'll be fine.
And build that pipeline. Now, here's one thing, and I don't know if anyone else can answer this for me. I read what I'm assuming is the same article you guys did, and a lot of the stuff on social media that was being taken away was, "Woo, down goes another pipeline." That really doesn't seem to be what actually happened. So what it seemed to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that, you know, the courts essentially said you have to go back and do this again, and you have to actually legitimately talk to First Nations people this time, but that didn't require them to follow what the request of the First Nations people were. It seems to me to be a speed bump, not a brick wall. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, but you're also, we did not tease what actually you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, we need to introduce itself.
Yeah. because what we're talking about here is the Northern Gateway Pipeline, right, which is the subject of the largest news story of the day.
Sorry about that.
No worries. I like it. It's like a trailer for the actual conversation. So yes, the Northern Gateway Pipeline approval was overturned, and that headline sounds massive, right? That headline is an attention-grabbing headline, and it's because the Federal Court of Appeal finds that Canada failed to consult with First Nations on a pipeline project. So this is one of the ongoing court battles that First Nations are consistently fighting against the Canadian government to really have their territory respected, and this one happened to go. Go the way of First Nations, and yes, basically it said that you did not successfully consult them. But of course, what's interesting about this is you're right. It sounds like basically they're like going back to interest. So first of all, it should be noted that the court did think that the actual company running this did successfully actually consult them, and it was the federal government that failed to.
I think they thought that both had failed, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, but there was one. There was a dissenting view of one judge who felt that due diligence had in fact been done on that.
So the point is that the exact phrase is undisclosed, undiscussed, and unconsidered. But what's interesting about this course is that what it's really saying here is go back and talk again. Not that you can't. Not that it's ever cannot be approved. But of course, what the real story here isn't so much that this particular thing happened. It's the growing momentum against Northern Gateway, especially as it still faces the climate test, and the Trudeau government campaigned on saying that there would be no tankers in the waters where Northern Gateway would require there to be tankers. So the chances of this pipeline are very low. And this is just one more blow to that entire thing. The eco-justice lawyer, Barry Johnson, says, between on-the-ground opposition and the federal government's promises to keep BC's North Coast tanker free and demonstrate climate leadership, this pipeline is never getting built. And I think you sort of have to... I personally agree with him. And I think that a lot of the ways are pointing that direction. For me, the story real here is that, yes, this isn't getting built, but what does that mean for Energy East, the other pipeline that is coming east instead of west? And every sign I'm seeing seems to point to the idea that Northern Gateway will be the thing that is sacrificed to push Energy East. We said this before on the show, and we say it again. I think that's what to look for here. It's not so much that, like, if they build both, I'll be blown away and incredibly depressed. But I think you're much more likely to see Northern Gateway and Energy's decisions come around at the same time. Energy's will get approved, Northern Gateway won't, which will at least to some extent coalesce opposition against pipelines to one pipeline, which could be helpful for those of us in the activist community.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Stefan, and I'm going to jump in and fact-check myself. Actually, you're right. The ruling did say that they felt that Northern Gateway had done those consultations. But I think it's obvious to point out the irony in that if that had actually been the case, would this have been so actively pursued by the First Nations in the legal system if they'd felt that they'd actually been adequately consulted by Northern Gateway in the first place? But in terms of the bigger picture, I think what we're seeing is that this new government is really positioning its strategy to do exactly what you've described, Stefan, because they've come out and overtly said that they see pipelines as being part of the solution, part of the transition to this cleaner economy. So in a way, you could see that they are positioning Energy East as the pipeline that's going to facilitate, you know, domestic growth and investment and spur us onward, and we're going to use the wealth that's generated by having this cross-Canada pipeline to advance those aims. And we all know that the science doesn't support that, obviously. But I think for me, the most important thing is that this really has been positioned by the proponents of Energy East as a great regional divide, and, you know, basically implying that those who do not support it, and we've seen a lot of opposition not only from Indigenous peoples but also from the province of Quebec, where a lot of the local mayors came out on behalf of their municipalities to say they didn't support it, and then were really really aggressively attacked by a lot of the Western political leaders, saying that, you know, that Canada as a whole had gained from the, you know, wealth of the tar sands, and now that, you know, places like Alberta was suffering, that they were just being unsupportive. And in a way, you know, this whole rhetoric is very much like what we've seen coming out of the U.S., that it's almost anti-Canadian not to support Energy East.
Well, it's the Rex Murphy argument, you know. The Alberta tar sands were there for us to give us jobs, and now we must be there for them. And it's just sort of like that. The amount of ideology required to make that sentence make sense is mind blowing.
Yeah, and it's because from people on that side of the political spectrum in general, but just, you know, it's hard to group people that way, but. There just seems to be, and it's something I've noticed after, you know, listening to hundreds of thousands of hours of, you know, news reports and reading, you know, thousands and thousands of articles over the year, that people who are fighting against these types of things, like fighting against climate regulation, fighting for pipelines, and saying that the people that say that you're un-Canadian if you don't support it, or that you're foolish if you don't support it, are all people that apparently can only calculate information that have to do with the next 15 minutes. Yes, if you do one-sided accounting and you sell a bunch of oil, great, $5 billion. But they refuse to admit that, 5 minutes later, you have an $8 billion bill for damage done by climate change. Like, they think that we're denying the first number. They think that we're denying that oil is valuable. And rather than the fact that they are rejecting the fact that there's two-sided accounting here and that there are costs that come with that. And it's so infuriating. It's as infuriating every single person that every person within range of my voice right now, regardless of as a recording, has been in a situation where someone has treated them, especially if you're a woman, has been treated by someone condescendingly about how foolish you are for thinking something that is so obviously and easily provably wrong. Everyone has had that experience once in their life. Women generally have it about once a day, at least. This is what we're talking about. People like Rex Murphy, people like even like Justin Trudeau, who are going out and saying, oh, come now, you're be serious. Really? If you want to put facts on the table, well, let's do this. Well, but their only argument, oh, is come on, let's be serious.
Well, I just, find it really interesting that it's so blatantly obvious that all these tar sands workers have lost their jobs, and that our response to that is to double down on the same strategy that has led to this mass unemployment, which is genuinely a concern and genuinely a hardship for a lot of people out west. But if a strategy fails and is evidenced by people losing their jobs, why would we then double down and invest in that same strategy? It makes absolutely
sugar's
no sense.
Sugar's delicious. If you eat a ton of it, you get diabetes. You know what cures diabetes? More sugar.
I was going to say, we didn't send, when the fish stocks collapsed in the Atlantic Ocean, our solution wasn't to send more fishermen out there.
One-up my metaphor. Way to go, Steve.
Thank you. But I think what's interesting about that is not only, you don't even have to go as far as you did, Darren, to actually make an argument against the sort of decision-making. It's the same as when you're looking at Donald Trump arguing, saying that we're gonna create all the new energy. Coal wasn't killed by climate regulations. Coal was killed by natural gas. And the reason why people were laid off in the West wasn't because of climate regulations. It was because the price of oil dropped so to be unsustainable, and it's still there. It has not rebounded, and that is the reason for the problems. None of the problems may have been exacerbated by their inability to get this, to slightly lower their transportation costs. But no amount of lowering the transportation costs can make what currently exists in the ground a viable market in the price of oil right now. So basically, you have to sit around hoping at some point the price will come back up and then you'll be fine. But that's a ridiculous economic decision for a serious company. No serious company would be like, okay, our outright cars right now are $20,000. We can make a car for $50,000 and then we'll be making money. Let's just wait until cars cost more money. This is brilliant. the oil obviously is a fluctuating market, but it's been around. There's no signs of decreasing. OPEC has not come together to actually raise the cost of oil. They've in fact had multiple conversations in which it seems like it's going to stay low. Iran's oil is coming on board now, so it's only going to keep the market low. And the idea that we're going to solve this, and again, I think it's truly a economic crisis Canada is facing to keep these people employed, but to do so in a way that was fundamentally against what we understand the economy exists right now doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It's a chasing your tail game. There is no amount. It doesn't matter if you're talking about one milliliter or 100 million barrels. There is zero amount of oil that can ever be sold at any price that any reasonable person, even the people making the arguments that I'm condescendingly talking to right now, where you can make more money off that oil than the long term cost of the climate change it will impact. Zero amount. There's no magic number. So Trudeau's just wrong. He's just wrong. And there is no amount. So anyone that's out there listening, or anyone that's ever heard that argument, there is no amount. There's no amount of oil that produces more value for us than the amount of damage it's going to do that we're going to have to pay for. So it's a loss. Every time you pull oil out of the ground, it's now a loss. The fact that that isn't mixed into the economics is not the environmentalist problem. That's the people arguing for its problem.
If I can tease a story we're talking at the end, Moody's has a thing to say about that. Largest crediting agencies. I feel like we're going to save that to the third section. But someone agrees with you, and it's a large crediting agency that recently also just downgraded Britain's credit from the AAA, which is just a fun fact for the day.
So, Emmy, why don't you get the last comment on this?
Yeah, just one more point before we go to our music break, which is that the government this year said that it was going to implement the UN DRIP. So that is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And why I'm raising this now is that I think what we're seeing is a government that wants to say yes to everything. They want to say yes to addressing climate change, but they also want to say yes to pipelines, and they want to say yes to a renewed relationship with indigenous peoples in this country. But if we're really going to implement UN DRIP, which includes, you know, the key principle of free, prior, and informed consent, so seeking that, for example, in advance of these resource projects being implemented, how can these things not be on a collision course? So I really think that our new government is setting itself up to be in a lot of hot water when all these things that they're saying yes to start to collide. So I just wanted to leave off on that point, that this was actually quite a major step as a country to say we're going to implement this. But what does it mean when we start looking at pipelines? And with that, I'll hand it back to Darren.
All right. So that's a good place for our music break. We will be back in just a moment to talk about Grassy Narrows with David Gray Donald, who's been patiently sitting here. And I've seen him wanting to reach for the microphone a couple times. Maybe he'll throw in some retroactive commentary as well after this break. But first, I would like to introduce some of our special guests that you haven't heard yet. Jeff and Andrea are our artist collective team, as well as accomplished musicians. And if they have not yet patented chalkboard international art, they should do so, as the Jeff doing all the wonderful art over at the Center for Social Innovation happens also both to be a pair of justice warriors, not always exclusively about the environment, but it comes up enough. And I've asked you to come in and share some of your musical talents with us by guest DJing. So, Jeff, please maybe do a quick introduction of yourself if you like, and then tell us what we're going to listen to.
Thank you very much, Darren, and thank you for having us on your Green Majority show. We founded Bureau of Power Light Art Collective a couple of years ago. We do intentional art to try to make the world a better place in whatever way we can. We thought today to start things off to celebrate Canada Day, and because we're talking about the pipeline, we want to give a shout out to First Nations folks in Canada and celebrate the people that were here first. We're going to play a tune called Working for the Government, by Buffy St. Marie, remixed by Tribe Called Red. And you're listening to Green Majority on CIUT 89.5.
All right, we are back. I really wish we could actually play all of the music choices, especially when they're so excellently chosen. We don't, but we will be listening all the information about how you find that. And you can check out Bureau of Light and Power as well on the show post today. So if you enjoyed that song, or if you want to learn more about what Jeff and Andrea do, you can check the show post today at greenmajority.ca. Without further delay, however, I would like to introduce our guest today, which is David Gray Donald, who is a Canadian journalist as well, writes for a wide variety of independent, to varying degrees of independent journalism, ranging from now Toronto, which is, for those of you who are not in Toronto, kind of like a local rag, but it's sort of thing. It's like a free newspaper, but unlike I think most free newspapers, they do quite a bit of actual journalism. It's kind of neat because every city I've been to has an independent journalism now. It seems to have a little more tank on it as well. The Toronto Media Co-op, and you've previously done stuff for Vice and a whole bunch of other news outlets as well. David's going to talk to us today a little bit about a couple of articles he's written about the Grassy Narrow. So I will simply pass it off to David now.
All right, thanks, Darren. Great to be here, and I have a little bit of a tickle in my throat. But I'm going to get through this, and this is going to be good. I'm really happy to be talking about Grassy Narrows First Nation in northwestern Ontario near the Manitoba border. And the name in the indigenous language, like the Anishinaabe Mohan language of the community, is Asubpiskosiwagong. Grassy Narrows is world famous, and not for the good reasons. I'm going to start with a little scene in the Ontario legislature that happened last month. So a bunch of youth from Grassy Narrows were sitting in the legislature watching the parliament, watching the Ontario politicians talk, and they were talking about Grassy Narrows First Nation and the mercury poisoning that has been there since the 1970s, 1960s actually. And the youth then were wearing these shirts that said, "Water is sacred." These blue shirts that say water is sacred. And they were asked to leave because having a motto or some sort of advertisement on your clothing in the legislature is not permissible. So they decided to keep the shirts on and walk out instead of take their shirts off because they believe water is sacred. The story of Grassy Narrows is pretty heartbreaking. There was a pulp and paper mill operating nearby in the river system, the Wabagoon River system, And it dumped about 10 tons of mercury in the 1960s and didn't tell the residents living downstream in Grassy Narrows First Nation. Since then, people have had a lot of trouble with mercury poisoning. They can't eat the fish in the lake, Clay Lake, which is teeming with fish. Like, this is a lake that is just packed with walleye, and they can't eat it, although some people still do. So this fight has been going on with the Ontario government for many, many years, and it's well documented. Scientists in Japan have studied it. But something new came up in the last little while that people might have seen, which is a study was released saying the government has been trying to let this water system remediate naturally. They'll just sort of let the mercury flush out or get buried by sedimentation. So it just like gets buried in the bottom of the rivers and lakes. It seems that hasn't worked. Mercury levels are still very high. And so the study has said there's a number of ways that it could be remediated, including sort of putting more sediment in the water to bury it faster. Now, new news came out very recently through a Toronto Star investigation. There are 50 barrels of mercury-containing liquid that were illegally buried near the old pulp and paper site, and no one knows where they are, what happened to them, and they can't, like, they just don't know where to find them. So there's mercury, there's an ongoing source of mercury, is what the scientists have been thinking, but they couldn't prove it. And then this guy who was part of burying the mercury in the 1970s, he just anonymously, or not anonymously, his name is known, but he sent an email to the Ontario government about 8 months ago saying, "Hey, I think I buried some mercury behind the old site in the 1970s, and the government supposedly did not act on this. The mercury, as far as we know, has not been found. The government has, at this stage now, pledged some money to studying mercury levels in the area and to try and find the source of mercury. It's a bit of a back and forth right now with the government and the First Nation, because the First Nation has been studying this for a very long time, and the government, you know, the individuals in the government switch all the time. So I think the government in a little bit of a case is struggling to figure out what they actually know, like what they have on file. And the Ontario Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Glenn Murray, has been sort of saying, we don't need to do any more studies. Now is the time for action. You know, he's really gung-ho. And then his government is like, oh, we need to do some more studies. And Kathleen Wynne has said that there's going to be action, but it's not really clear what it's going to be. Kathleen Wynne is the Premier of Ontario. The other side of Grassy Narrows, and why it's actually really famous in the activist community, is that since December 2nd, 2002, they have been blockading a logging road in their community, and it's still going, 14-year logging blockade. There was clear cutting happening on their lands, and I'm actually just going to read quickly a little thing that Judy De Silva, who is an elder in the community there, wrote recently in the Dominion magazine, which is of the media co-op. And this is her writing. "The Anishinaabeg have been closely tied to the land and water since time immemorial. It's the lifeblood of our culture and way of life. The logging industry's devastation of the land and water has effectively destroyed my people in all aspects, culturally, economically, and socially. I call logging genocide of my community. Our people were up against the wall, and we saw no choice but to stand up and act." And they have been, this is the longest running blockade in Canada, logging blockade in Canada. The youth of Grassy Narrows recently put out a music video called Home to Me, which is super inspiring. They're very proud of where they're from. They're bringing their traditional culture back. It's quite an amazing story of sort of resurrection of, you know, faced with this mercury poisoning and with clear cutting of their, like, huge swaths of their land, they're still loving where they're from and standing up for their health and for their culture. So I'm really inspired by the youth there and the elders. I think that's most of where we're at with Grassy Narrows right now. We can open it up maybe. Just to recap, like, there are buried barrels of mercury somewhere, haven't been found. Government says they want to act on this mercury problem, but it's not clear what they're going to do.
So, David, first of all, thank you very much. And part of the reason I appreciate you, having you on the show and other similar local journalists as well is that you guys have the ability to sort of hone in and narrow in on things it's just beyond the ability of us to do here. So, I mean, thank you so much for coming and sharing that. We've mentioned this before, and Stefan and I talked about this on the show before, that unfortunately we end up sort of opting not to talk about certain First Nations issues. It's not because we're trying to censor it. It's because we understand how devastatingly little we understand about it, and we don't want to. It would feel like it's almost more damaging to talk about it inaccurately than to not mention it in this case. And so, doubly do. And I'm glad that we're on Canada Day taking such a focus on First Nations communities. The first thing that really jumped out at me about what you said was that I had to stop myself from jumping in at the beginning, because I did promise you'd have at least a minute of solid airtime without me interrupting. Was to feel the need that, like, as a context thing, right? Mm. So when you said, they can't fish, in my head immediately, I have this thing where I've sort of trained myself to listen from other people's ears and, like, what would XYZ people, how would they hear that? And I'm worried, I don't know, but I'm concerned that a lot of people would hear that and go, oh, poor you can't fish. Mm. Taking that from the point of view of, like, your average, suburbanite with a cottage. Oh, you can't fish. Well, too bad. You go boating instead. No. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the foundation of their culture. And the closest thing I could come up with, and you tell me how far off point I might be with this, was that it might be similar to telling your average Torontonian, suburbanite, that they can't have the internet. Like, it doesn't actually destroy their culture, but it comes pretty close to eradicating the way that they live their life in a debilitating way that fundamentally alters how they live their life. I realize there's a disagreement there, but just as far as, I'm not trying to say, like, that's an accurate comparison. What I'm trying to say is, like, that's the level of impact that we're talking about. Like, about, if you people freak out if they don't have the internet for 2 days, well, these people have lost a significant part of their culture for 35, 40 years.
I don't want to say, but they eat the fish.
Yeah, you don't eat the internet.
From the point of view of people that don't understand that as, like, an intrinsic fundamental part of
no,
a culture,
no, for sure,
they might just say, well, just go to the grocery store and eat bread.
Right. But I think I understand what you're trying to get at, but I think this is even more fundamental than anything. This is literally, like, this is one of the two, this is both of the two things we say are required for life, water and food. Like, this isn't something that's sort of a necessary part of it. This is literally what they need to survive, and that's the first time I've used literally in actually the literal way in at least a year.
Yeah. But yes, and I understand it might be misviewed. What I said is, might be taken the wrong way. But what I'm trying to get at was that when people who aren't aware of what a non-suburbanite, North American culture is like, may simply hear that and dismiss it, thinking, well, whatever, just go buy some macaroni and cheese from the store, and they may not have any understanding of the depth. And the seriousness of sort of what you're saying. So yes, to acknowledge that, and just so that nobody misunderstood what I was trying to get
for
at.
For sure. And I guess what also wasn't important to mention is the number of people, the actual overall overwhelming health impacts that people in the Grassy Narrows are actually currently suffering. The amount of mercury poisoning is overwhelming, and devastating.
Yeah. One of the people who's 19 years old, Darwin Fobister. From Grassy Narrows, who did a lot of work making the music video that I mentioned, Home to Me. He suffers from mercury poisoning, where has trouble walking, and strength issues are a problem. So, like, holding on to things is an issue for him. The fish is so much a part of life, and I think what I take away from this example in particular is, the treaties that First Nations and Canada signed allowed for people to continue their way of life, hunting, fishing, gathering. This is really taking away a pillar of life. And so these people, like, the fish are there. They are, like, people could eat the fish, except they're poison. So this is one of those cases where it's sort of like, why don't people, you know, why don't these, you know, in white Canada, I hear stuff like, why don't these First Nations, like, you know, if they actually care about hunting and gathering, why don't they do it? It's like, well, they really can't in this case. Although some old people do, because they're like, as a matter of principle and pride, they still fish.
And I think another huge thing that people don't really realize is that when you have mercury in water, we've already talked about this on the show, when that's introduced to the fish in the area, that's bioaccumulated and biomagnified. So smaller fish, bigger fish eat the smaller fish with mercury poisoning. So in the bigger fish, the mercury is biomagnified. So when the person eats it, then it affects them a lot more. And I think in grassy narrows, it's hundreds of times more parts per billion than it should be.
Around 150 times in some cases.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's extremely, and the Minamata disease, which is mercury poisoning. What I really find interesting is that they had the Japanese scientists come to review what it is, just to see the side effects. But it seems like they didn't really do anything about it. They just kind of wanted to study it.
Yeah, and I just want to jump in, and David, you alluded to this a bit, but one of the major points of friction is that there has been this study, I believe, that was commissioned by Grassy Narrows First Nation, and it involved the original scientists that actually studied the issue. And basically a huge point of conflict is now that the First Nations believes that the government could take measures to reconstitute the area, and the government's, as you said, sort of said, whoa, no, we're not sure that that wouldn't do more damage than good. And so really we're seeing the science that was commissioned by the First Nation come up against the government position right now. So they are in a way refuting that and saying, oh no, we need more time. Whereas, you know, the First Nation has contracted a lot of experts to come and give another opinion, which seems to point at this time to the fact that measures could be taken on behalf of the government to reconstitute the area.
Yeah. When we get into the remediation science, and thanks for bringing it up, the general idea is to do what is called an enhanced natural remediation, which would be to apply basically like dump or mix in a whole bunch of dirt into the water, like clean dirt, and then the clean dirt will settle on the lake floor and bury the mercury. Once it's buried by 10 centimeters or more, it's effectively out of the ecosystem. Only like a giant earthquake would mix it back up. Now, I think what the Ontario government is alluding to in terms of doing more damage is basically like excavating parts of the river floor or lake floor, which is not what is recommended for the lakes, because this digging stuff up could mix things. But there might be small sections of rivers that have high mercury contamination that it might make sense to do a bit of dredging, some excavating. But that would be a very small area, because sedimentation doesn't work as well in fast-moving rivers. I think it's more so it's the government trying to buy time and avoid making a firm commitment to do any one course of action. And I've asked them through email several times like what they're committed to doing, and they're going to do studies this summer about what sites are more and less contaminated, which they say is in line with the study. There is a bit of friction between the First Nation and the government still, and it's going to be developing.
So I think right before we go to our second break here, I think the last thing I want to get at, and so Stefan and I sort of waxed on about this several weeks ago, but we didn't have you here, so I'll just simply repeat my comment and see what you think of it, was just that the idea here is there seemed to be a lot of delay, this doesn't need to happen, and as you were outlining, there is... In context, you know, it's not the full story, but within parts of the story, there are legitimate arguments as to why not to do certain things. So it's not, I don't think this is completely a case of just like, haha, screw you. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. But all of a sudden, there has been all this attention sort of focused on it and put on it. And my comment before in this, Stefan and I were talking, was essentially this was a case of, Stefan, you'll remind me who this was that we were listening to at that conference, but the guy that was like, told all about the conversation with the politician, and he was like, yeah, but it's not going to cost me any votes.
Keith Stewart.
Thank you. Keith Stewart making that comment about, and do you feel, and I realize I'm just asking you for your opinion here, but do you feel this is a case of not doing anything about this problem isn't going to cost me anything, and doing something about this problem might? or what?
I think it's going to cost them. They're going to look bad. I was reflecting last night that I think today, the 149th birthday of Canada, we're going to look back on this last year as the year we realized that this nation has been engaged in cultural genocide since its founding. And I think people won't let this kind of environmental racism stand. The remediation costs are expected to be quite low, sort of around $5 million a year, which when you compare that to a lot of government services is very low. And this has been happening, like poisoning and literally killing people since the 1970s. I think there is outrage about this. It was front page of the Toronto Star a little while ago. People are taking notice, and they don't want to live in a province that poisons people. I think it will cost some votes, at least if it seems like the government is negligent.
Mm. But that seems to be the thing that has kicked them into action, as sort of is what we were pointing out, was that when there wasn't enough attention on it, that it wasn't costing them votes, they were happy to not do anything about it. Mm. But now, you know, and the situation hasn't really changed. I mean, there's this new report, but I mean, ultimately the situation is the same. But it's now that people are paying attention to it, and they're doing something about it too. And this is a case of, A, you know, don't give them complete credit. They're just watching out for their own butts. But also B, I think the other thing to highlight here, and I'll give you the final comment before the break, is also like, hey, talking about stuff works. Yeah. I'll give you the final comment and we'll go to break.
Yeah, and I'd give a shout out to the people who've been fighting for this particular case for years, because this wasn't getting traction for a very long time, but people kept fighting, the activist community, the Indigenous community, and here we are.
Hear, hear. All right, so we're going to go to our second and final music break. Thank you very much to David Gray Donald for joining us. He will be sticking around for the final section, possibly to jump in, and hopefully as well the bonus show. If you're a new listener in any way, you may not realize, but we are a live syndicated show internationally at this point as well. We have a number of stations in Canada and some outside as well, and extremely diverse, and I do watch the metrics. We have podcast listeners from all over the world, most recently with some ticks from Brazil, Stefan.
Oh, fun.
So we're always picking up people all over the world. One of the perks of the podcast is that we do have an extended section that is off air that allows us a little bit more freedom. Occasionally there's some naughty language, but it's all in good fun, and we just sort of let our hair down a little bit in the section. So if you're curious to hear even more, if you're not sick of us yet, go ahead and download the podcast. You can find that at greenmajority.ca, and there's other information and other content there as well. But without any further delay, once again, Jeff from Bureau of Light and Power. I always get that wrong. Is that right?
Bureau of Power and Light.
I always get it backwards. Thank
you're close.
You.
You got the words right.
please preview our next music break for us.
Thank you again for having us, Darren. So all of this talk about poisoning our environment and talking about government action, there is also another narrative in this, and this is our own actions and what we buy and our lifestyles that we live that contribute to this. So one of our first projects from our art collective called Maggot, M-A-G-T, has a song called Footprints, and this song is all about that, the choices that we make and the consequences thereof on our environment. So here it is, Footprint by Maggot. You're listening to Green Majority, CIUT 89.5.
And we're back. You're listening to the Green Majority here on the CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful community radio partners all the way across the country and now internationally as well, or possibly on the podcast or on as well off rabble.ca, who's also a place that our mid-guest, David Gray Donald, has published as well. Also happens to promote our podcast, which is fabulous, so we like them. We're running a little tight on time, so I'm going to cut the chitty chat and throw right to, I believe, Emma, who's going to introduce our first international story. Emma.
Well, before I get there, I'm just going to wrap up the Canada and review section. So just a few comments on some of the key steps that has been taken around addressing climate change by our new government. So the year basically kicked off. They were coming off their sort of high from participating in COP21. And basically they had taken the position that they were going to tackle this problem in collaboration with the provinces. So they went to Vancouver and they came out with the Vancouver Declaration. And guess what? There was no new emissions reduction target that came out of that. And the key policy point, I think, that the Liberals had hoped to really gain a lot of ground with, which was around carbon pricing, was pretty much derailed at the Vancouver Climate Conference, because not all the premiers, and you may guess which ones, were on board with carbon pricing. So that led to the creation of some working groups on carbon pricing and clean energy and jobs, etc. and have sort of brought us to the current state of affairs, which is the fact that the government is doing these national consultations. So you might note that your local Liberal MP is hosting a consultation near you. And from the civil society side, it gave way to or gave rise to the launch of the People's Climate Plan, which has three principles that are being put forth to government, which is that we want to build a plan that aligns with the science of climate change, so this commitment around keeping global average temperature rise under 1.5 degrees Celsius, the desire for a plan that builds a 100% renewable energy economy by 2050, and lastly, there is the justice-based principle. So they want a plan that's justice-based and really looks at the principles of reconciliation with Indigenous peoples and also addresses the fact that workers are being laid off and put out of work, and the transition needs to support a new type of employment. So with that, I will move straight to the international context, which is the fact that the North American Leaders Summit has just taken place in Ottawa. It's been almost a decade since Canada hosted this summit. And basically, the leaders are very proud to point out that the summit had really produced some good outcomes for climate and the environment. So one was this commitment to having 50% of energy be clean energy by 2025. And this is a bit of a false achievement for Canada, because if you look at what's included in the energy mix, they actually include nuclear in that. So it's not as wonderful as what it seems. In Canada, if we include nuclear, it's actually already surpassed this. So this is not a great achievement.
So we're saying we did it.
Yeah,
we're
basically saying we did it. And of course, that's not true for the U.S. and Mexico. But if you're including nuclear, it's not quite as clean as being projected there. And then the other commitment that was related to that came out of this was this commitment that we heard from Obama and Trudeau after their last meeting, which is to cut methane emissions from the oil and gas industry by as much as 45% from 2012 levels by 2025. So I think Stefan had a few comments on this leaders' summit.
Yeah. What I find interesting about that methane cutting is that it gets brought up all the time, and it makes me just think it must be really easy. Like, the number of times that people have come out, you know, even oil and gas leaders come out, and that's their thing they want to do, it kind of scares me. Because it kind of feels like they've decided that they're going to take this target, which sounds audacious. It sounds like a very, very deep goal. But they throw it around like it's candy, and it makes me seriously wonder how much are we wasting right now that this is something that can be sort of consistent, can be trumpeted as something as like a main point by basically everyone. They also, of course, agreed to try to reduce black carbon soot emissions and find alternatives to HFCs, which remains a pet amusement of mine, given the fact that the ozone layer is actually healing. That was a fun news story that I wrote. We're not covering this week, but maybe we'll get to it next week. Also, we had an avid listener, Dave, call us. Thanks, Dave. I think that's not my brother, for those who know that I have a brother named Dave. I think it's someone else. I think it would have been meaner had it been my brother, but thanks, Dave, for the call. And to switch, to carry on to in our sort of quick fire of all these different international stories, I teased this before, which was Moody's now taking in four measures to assess the infrastructure of corporate sectors in the light of the UN agreement to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius. Of course, Moody's is one of the largest accrediting agencies. They're the most commonly referenced. If you're paying any attention during the debt ceiling crisis in the United States, or even more recently with Britain, they are sort of the standard bearer of deciding how, you know, basically why this matters is if people, it's the chance of which you will pay back your debt, and the worse your credit is, according to Moody's, the higher interest rates you will get. So it's harder to then actually get debt or to get out of debt because you're paying high interest rates, because they think you're less likely or you're less good person to do this. Also, the manipulation of these different things is what caused the debt crisis in 2008. So there's a whole bunch of things going on here. However,
The Moody's actually they've taken four measures, and the four measures are policy and regulation, regulatory uncertainty regarding emissions and policies, declining profitability and cash flows due to capital expenditure and operating costs, demand substitution and changes in consumer preferences, and technology developments that accelerate the adoption of low carbon technologies. And so a lot of this is, you know, especially within something like coal, which, you know, has already, as most people who are looking at the global market understand, that coal is dead, especially in the Western context, in part because of these sort of its inability to actually get funding for new projects. It cannot find new funding projects, and so can't expand. In our system requires you to expand or die. And so that's a little piece of good news along with the ozone for us. But Darren, you have a sort of a pet interest in one of the news stories we wanted to cover. So I'm going to tease to you for what will likely be the last story of this show.
Yeah, well, thanks, Devin. I'm actually going to cheat because I'm going to shotgun four into one, but I'm going to use them when you were teasing in as a main thing. So there's one story that really grabbed my attention today called, the title of which was Florida Declares State of Emergency, Local Emergency Over Influx of God-Awful Toxic Algae. That does not really do it justice. Really do go to the website and look at the links if you can't find the story on your own. It's on The Guardian. The pictures are absolutely horrifying. Like, it doesn't look like the face of Earth except for the boats that you can recognize in and among it. Blue-green algae is really nasty stuff, and it's algae, so people aren't going to take it seriously. But as a byproduct, when it dies, maybe in the bonus show, we won't have time now, but maybe in the bonus show, Sabina, our local science expert, will maybe wax on about this a bit more. But it's really nasty stuff. It's extremely toxic. It's extremely likely, it's virtually certain it will impact local marine life. It's also causing rashes and respiratory issues. Basically, as this blue-green algae dies, it produces a toxin. It also, I mean, if nothing else, the least of which is that it's causing a foul smell and moving down the coast of Florida. And basically, that you can't do anything about it. That's one of the big issues here. So there's really no remediation for this problem other than waiting for it to go away. And when it dies, when it goes away, the process of going away is when it produces most of the toxins. So this is pretty serious. So I'm going to tie this into... I'm not even going to get into them. I'm just going to mention the headlines. Wildfires engulfing the West Coast are fueled by climate change. This is not the same story I'm repeating. This is yet another issue of wildfires, yet another system of floods. As well, there's another quick thing I'll mention here, which is the millions exposed to dangerous lead levels in the U.S. Report finds, which is basically saying that the issues that we're seeing in Flint water with all the controversy there, that there's dozens of cities, that probably more, that also fall into this category that simply haven't made the headlines. So the one I want to end on, which is not the one I started with, which is the one Stefan thought I was going to tease, because I actually forgot about this story, and we can't not mention it as well. We may get into this later, but it really only needs a line of comment, which is unprecedented. Scientists declare global climate emergency, that phrase gets used so much, I don't think that will get people's attention. So let me draw your attention to it. After jet stream crosses the equator. So for those of you who haven't taken a climate science course or have not been paying attention, when scientists talk about, like, those things that we should be really terrified, we have to be terrified of them maybe happening, this is one of those things, and it just happened. Because this could very likely, not could like, oh, it might not, it will very likely, especially if the trend continues, which, like, you know, it does if we know what caused it, lead to essentially the elimination of regular seasons, which, in case you're not paying attention, means no food production, which, in case you're not paying attention, means billions dead with a B. Right? So am I guaranteeing that from this news story that next week there'll be a billion dead? No, but we're clearly on the path to it. Dave, we're going to have to save a bonus show. I know, sorry, you had your hand up to jump in there. We're out of time. All right, so now we'll go to our bonus show. If you're listening, we'll be right back. Other than that, have a good green week, folks, and we'll see you all real soon.